There was no handle, no knocker, no lock. Just a dark keyhole for teeth that would have been the longest being stunned. She peered through the keyhole and saw jack shit. Suffice to say, all pushing, gripping, finger inserting, and pressing was in vain. It was locked as damn. Furious, thought Gideon. She went back to the claustrophobic little vestibule and, out of a complete sense of perversity, passed the tapestry back up so that the door was totally covered. In the shadows, the effect was very bold. Nobody'd be finding that anytime soon. It was a stupid, secretive night thing to do, done out of habit, and Gideon hated how comforting it felt. Voices were fading into the edge of her hearing from the top of the ladder that led to the stairs. Another ninth instinct had Gideon flattening herself back into the bottom of the stairwell, then a million times before to avoid the Marshal of Yearburg or Harrowhart, or one of the god-awful Great Aunts, or members of the Lock Two close to her. Gideon had no idea whom she was avoiding, but she avoided them anyway, because it was such an easy thing to do. A conversation conducted in low, rich, peevish tones drifted down. Mystical, oblique claptrap, someone was saying. I have half a mind to write to your father. What? Drawled another. That the first house isn't treating us fairly? A lateral puzzle isn't a trial. And now that I think about it, well, the idea that the old fogey doesn't know a thing about it is beyond belief. Some geriatric playing mind games, or worse, and this is my theory, wanting to see who breaks. Ever the conspiracy theorist, said the second voice. The first voice was aggrieved. Why are the shuttles gone?
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 9. Fix your face, idiot. I'm so excited. We have our very first guest, Knight. Can I have you introduce yourself?
I'm Knight, ACM pronouns. I have been tangential to the fandom for a while, but I didn't actually read the book until about a year after it was introduced to me through Han. I was working a warehouse job and we were allowed to wear headphones, which was nice. So I got the audiobook and that really kind of launched me into it. I have done most of my fandom stuff with Han and them doing my makeup, which has been great. I have a big love for Ordis, who y'all will hear about way down the line. And my perspective that made me really fall in love with the series was the theological takes and the religious takes that were in the books. I thought they were very fun and interesting. Shout out to the Catholics. Y'all really know how to inspire your people for better or for worse. And that has always led to very creative art and creative takes on matters of God and being in the soul and all the like. So,
We're in Act Two, and for the first time, the skull at the very beginning of the chapter is not a first house or a ninth house skull. It started off always ninth house, and then there were a couple of chapters that were first house as we were like receiving the Emperor's summons. And now the skull at the top of the chapter is the third house, which suggests to us, that's really what we should be paying attention to in this chapter.
I do have to say that this is, I think, the fifth. This is like where the actual like I'm just like, oh, I love Magnus so much. Like I'm reading through this and I'm like, oh, I want to cosplay Magnus again. I'm just like, I love Magnus so much.
I'm with you. I think it's really interesting that this is a third house skull because in our production notes, the way that I summarized this episode was we meet the bad teens. That was the thing that I thought was really important about this chapter. Not we get this insight into, Ianthe and all that, but it's interesting. The two big plot points of this chapter are Gideon's encounter with the relationship between the fifth and the fourth, and then how the third is kind of operating internally. And it's an interesting contrast between, Magnus and the teens and how they're interacting with each other versus how this other parallel trio is interacting with each other.
And it's also the different family dynamics that are presented, because you have two sets of family here.
Yeah, and the degree of like earnest, direct, pretty transparent communication versus like the high protocol relationships that are like the majority of Gideon's experience. Like Gideon is seeing these much more at ease casual interactions, much less self-conscious between each other than I think a lot of Gideon's interactions have been in the first bit of the book so far.
And interestingly, both of these trios include a correction. Magnus is sort of chiding the twins not to be rude at Gideon. And Corona very harshly corrects Nibirius as well.
Yeah, given that that has also been a big piece we've seen in terms of Gideon's relationships earlier. Constant, fairly violent correction.
So Magnus is really set off immediately as, this gentle parenting star.
He wants him. I love him so much. And just like the first genuinely kind person we have met in this book.
Yes. I think this is probably the first moment of softness you really see also in the book with Magnus, but also I think the first clear view of venom we really get out of the third, because I think previously we're aware that each group is operating differently, right? You see, like, it is more game style competitiveness than it is like the actual threat that other necromancers are. I don't think Gideon has actually seen full sail quite yet.
Yeah, and seeing via the third this adversarial default that Harrow also brought to the table, like it's not actually part of this larger invitation that they be competitive. It's not necessary, but the ninth and the third are like it is.
Harrow and Ianthe are very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Before Gideon even leaves the room, she encounters two challenges. First, Harrow's weird ass notes. And second, a very unfamiliar bathroom. Harrow leaving tons of notes obviously becomes a major theme in the rest of the series, and leaving notes for people is a major communication strategy for Harrow throughout her life.
That's fair, now that you pointed out. Yeah, she does do that quite a bit.
Which means that she's constantly having conversations with other people in her head. And she's like, oh, let me make sure that you know that we had this conversation in my head and you should know what you need to take away from it.
She leaves the first note crumpled, stuffed in between Gideon's hand and the hilt of her rapier, which she had been holding in her sleep.
And
Everybody in
then.
this scene is so fucking weird.
You know what's interesting where she doesn't leave a note, though? In the bathroom. Like, she doesn't leave it under the soap or even, or like on top of the soap or even near the anti-bac gel, which I think goes to show that though Gideon has somewhat cleaned herself, Harrow has not.
Harrow has never washed her hands a day in her life.
Disgusting child.
And I think there's another thing with that where there's been this creator that I've been following. She's commonly known as the Knitting Cult Lady, but she was talking about how like control of the body is part of like systems of control. Like control of hygiene is interesting, where we're learning that like control of hygiene is not actually part of the ways that the ninth enforces itself.
Yeah, it seems like normatively it is, but this is actually a place where Harrow otherwise uncharacteristically deviates, because she mentions in an earlier chapter that the standard would be for Gideon to shave her head every day, but she doesn't actually expect Gideon to do that. And normally Harrow is so committed to the standards, but it seems like hygiene is a place where she personally just doesn't pay attention to stuff. So maybe she also kind of doesn't expect anyone else to take that seriously.
Well, I mean, isn't this may be jumping a bit far ahead, but I forget where I think it is in the second one where she's like, she's never seen her face without paint because she like sleeps in it or whatever.
She does sleep in it, and even when she does take a bath, she takes a bath in like an inch of tepid water. She's so weird. Gideon also slept in her paint last night, but normally
Yeah.
doesn't.
I mean, she normally doesn't paint her face, to be fair.
They don't have sinks on the ninth. They don't. Water is, I guess, too precious to use for cleaning. And so Gideon knows what a sink is from her comic books, but that is her point. She's explicitly like, I know what that is. I saw that in comic book.
Seeing Gideon yelp and like this is the first time we've really seen Gideon like, a little bit tilted, like at the splashing of water. Gideon's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, she knows what the sink is, but she has never even heard of a shower. She does not know what shower is about, and she's not down.
She will not be entering that. No, thank you.
Also, the idea that anti-back gel is a really routine part of their daily hygiene is that, like, this is such a med nerd thing, but like, why is that part of your antibiotic stewardship? That is not responsible antibiotic stewardship unless they have a very different relationship to the idea of antibiotic resistance than we do.
I also imagine it as like the antibacterial gel that I use from time to time, which is alcohol based.
Just hand sanitizer. Yeah,
Yeah.
it might be.
And like that as like what? And Gideon uses it to wash her face, which just like hand
Uncomfortable.
sanitizer to clean face. But it an alcohol, would an alcohol based, no, an alcohol based cleanser wouldn't take off grease paint.
An alcohol-based hand sanitizer would definitely take off face paint, but it would be really bad on your skin.
It could just be its own new thing because
Yeah.
the universe was completely destroyed. Perhaps microbacterial life forms are just different.
That's very possible. Like, it might be that this is a really, really different medical technology than what we're imagining. The description of anti-back gel kind of suggests hand sanitizer, kind of suggests like the gels that we're familiar with, but it could be totally different.
Do you think bacteria would emit thanergy when they're killed with an antibac?
Really small thanergy.
I think we're skipping over the fact that Gideon was like, no to soap because it's usually made from human fat.
It's interesting that she'd be
But what
disgusted
if.
by that since it was just culturally normal in her setting. Like, lots of stuff was made out of people on the ninth. The fact that she finds that really horrifying is interesting.
But what would they have used it for then? Because I don't think human fat would clean the same as other
I don't
liquid
know. I think
fat.
like the process of making soap from fat, I haven't seen it actually be like it's translatable to a lot of different fats. I don't think it's about effectiveness.
The only reference I am familiar with of making soap out of human fat is Fight Club.
What?
Yeah.
Wait,
Oh God,
what
I'm
happens in
remembering.
Fight Club?
They go to the back of a liposuction place and pull out massive bags of like jiggly yellowy tissue. And then they make a luxury soap brand to sell to rich people.
Historically, human fat has been used, taken from unclaimed corpses, to produce soap and candles, but human fat is not super good quality, and obviously there are ethical issues for use of human remains. Soaps made from human fat on a very, very quick web search here are not as like stable. They don't create like as hard set a soap, so they're maybe like softer, kind of grosser to work with, and maybe don't lather as well as like beef tout.
Interesting.
Yeah, because different fats would have different melting points, and that wouldn't change regardless of what other stuff you used.
I think it is very, very cute in the breakfast scene when Magnus goes over to introduce himself, and it's interesting that like he introduces himself as an equal to Gideon, right? And is holds out his hand to shake and stuff. But the twins are like, no, man, no, don't bring us into this. And I think that is very cute because it's just very childlike, your uncle goes over to say hi to someone and
Yeah, on this rereading, I have been really aware of, particularly in these early chapters, how obsessed Gideon is with embarrassment, how much embarrassment comes up, and how much that shapes her experience of what she's encountering with other people. Like, she frames the teenagers in such abusive and threatening terms. Every single description, they're awful teens, they're ghastly teens, that like, and she sees them talking to each other and then looking at her and then talking to each other, and she's like, these people are monsters. And it's like she actually is just feeling insecure. They're friends with each other and she doesn't have any friends, and she's just feeling like super vulnerable.
Effie's like the only teen she's ever seen before.
Yeah.
As NCR would say, teenagers scared the living shit out of me.
At the same time, Gideon immediately clocks Magnus as wholesome. She describes him as wholesome. She's like, this guy is solid.
She has never seen a dad before, and yet when presented with a dad, she knew the shape of it, and that was Magnus.
Yeah, I'm like, what else wholesome would Gideon have ever experienced up to this point?
Nothing.
He's being nice to teenagers.
Yeah.
She's seeing him be a mentor to these teenagers and not beating the shit out of them and making fun of them and degrading them. And she's just like, this guy's all right. This guy's solid.
And her insecurity and her recognition of his solidness, like, is then compared to like Harrow, where she can like hear Harrow's voice in her mind and her like pre-programmed beliefs about the fifth, which is that they are a threat, versus this impression that is warming her in a way that's like quite affecting. And she's like, oh, I don't like what I was told about these people. They actually seem really nice.
I mean, also, to Magnus's credit, he can probably see that in her, right? Like, I remember talking with Han about this, I guess, years ago now. Magnus is one of the few actual adults in this scene. And to him, Gideon looks like a child. And so he sees this child in this makeup. And I think in some ways is, yes, a newly minted adult. How much of an adult do I treat you like? Versus, like, how much of a teenager do I still treat you like? And I think in him, kind of like, he's not intimidated by her, right? Is nice, because you kind of get that immediate that push that most teenagers give you, right? As someone who works with kids and works with young adults, there's always that push that teenagers give, and the whole thing is to let them push, right? That they need to know that that boundary is there, and they need to find out if that is a healthy boundary for them. And that's okay. And Magnus kind of gives her that space and then leaves her alone. And it's nice. And I think that that's what Gideon senses from him and what he sees. Like, part of this, he probably sees her being somewhat awkward, even if she has the sunglasses on. And he's like, okay, well, I've pushed this kid far enough. I'm going to go take mine and we're going to do something else.
I think it's interesting that like the third and the fifth are mentioned as like things to be concerned about, because it probably means that they know more than the other houses about the ninth. Like, Magnus may also, in addition to this kindness towards a newly minted adult, be also being like, this is a child who is having to live a very dark life. And like, I could imagine that he would have at least some idea that being a young cavalier on the ninth is a really different experience from being a young cavalier on the fifth. And I can't imagine, but some empathy and like a little bit of sadness. And so there's this extra gentleness of like, well, you're here and you deserve kindness, because it's probably not been easy just getting to here.
We know that there were outsiders who still visited the ninth up to about 5 years ago. So Magnus is almost certainly aware of the fact that nearly all the children on the planet died.
And he says,
Yeah.
health to the ninth.
Oh, that's a good point, because I bet Magnus wasn't expecting to see children arrive. Both Gideon and Harrowheart, hearing that all the children had died, was probably expecting to see a very cross adults, and now he has this these two babies that, you know, yeah, that's fair. I didn't think about that. Sad.
Coming from, being very close to Magnus's age, the difference between, a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old doesn't look that big from that perspective. And I could see him very much being like, oh yeah, we'll just scoop the ninth kids right next to the fourth kids. Like, it's all the same from here. I also would like to personally fight Tamsin Muir in a parking lot regarding her choice to describe Magnus as terminally jolly. Fuck you, man.
I can't really put it, in terms of one and two, but like Magnus and Abigail are the first to go. And I think it was with their death that I was like, oh, no one gets to be okay. Yeah, they're like, here is this warm, soft, beautiful cinnamon bun that you are going to immediately love every interaction you have with. And then she comes in and she's like, this is your lesson.
Yeah, their death is really the confrontation moment of like, this is serious. I told you it was dangerous. I told you people were going to die, but like, we're in it now.
And I think also to what Sarah was saying, it's like the first bastion of protection is gone. Like, you will not be relying on these characters for any sense of comfort. And to this day, I always think about how they died and Gideon's reaction to it, the fact that they died holding each other. And I can very much imagine Magnus cradling Abigail. And the first thing Gideon thinks is like they would not have died like that. Like, it's unnatural. Like, there's no way that their bones would have been like that. You know, like, to Gideon, it seemed unfathomable
The
that that's
tenderness.
probably the kindest death that we get throughout the whole book. Also, love Magnus so much and Abigail.
It's this little breath of what's possible emotionally that, like, I think as readers we hold on to and like look for in each book as we successively get to there, because now we know the flavor of that we will get these moments of relief and tenderness in, and now we're like, okay, I want another one, please. This one, because it is really like the contrast is quite distinct emotionally as a reader. You're a monster.
I love that the twin or the not the twins. I love that the teens' protests to Magnus are in tiny type. I know that y'all both mostly listened in audiobook, but in the print edition, when it, no, Magnus, don't say we're overcome. It's in a smaller font.
I hear it in my head where it's like, no, Magnus, don't say we're overcome. Like, it's like a really, like, whingy, like, not quite committing to commit. There's a tone.
That I imagine it as when I'm working with my youth in kids' church, when their grandparents are telling me something about their youth that the grandparents think is important, which, to be fair, may actually be important for my job at times, but the kids don't want me to know. And they're like, don't say that. Like, they're clawing at their parent. And I just have to stand there, like, professionally while they're going through whatever they're going through. And I'm just like, yes, okay. And then the kid just looks at me with daggers like it's somehow my fault. I'm like, anyway, glad
The
that
ultimate
interaction
betrayal.
happened. Yeah. Also, what's interesting that we get in this chapter is two very important characterizations of Gideon is that, one, she is much more than a job. She is quite smart. She mentions this when she says, you know, you don't learn nothing by being around an astrophysicist. By proxy, she has learned quite a bit about bone magic and that the magic operating these bones is extremely sophisticated. And that, too, she's curious. The first thing she does when she's by herself isn't go back to her room or eat or bother people, is she just goes to look around and is captivated by the beauty of the place. So I think that's very interesting because when we first meet her, you know, she's just trying to escape, very goal oriented. And now that she just kind of gets to do what she wants, she's very engaged with the environment and very imaginative. I think very imaginative in a way that Harrow Hark isn't. Harrow is very in the present and very clear about her intentions. Whereas I feel like every scene we get where Gideon is imagining the place is always a sense of wonder and beauty.
That contrast that you pull out between Harrow's sort of like present literalism and Gideon's expansive, wondrous imagination is something I never really thought about, but I think you're completely correct. I think that's a really interesting lens to look at their difference through.
I was having a conversation yesterday with someone who listens to our podcast, actually, about the importance of boredom. Like, we can also see how Harrow isn't someone who ever really allows herself to have idle time. That presentness, that literalism, she's always got something that she's trying to do or solve. And Gideon probably has had some degree of idle time comparatively in her upbringing, but like, this is probably, in terms of both idle time and novelty, like one of a pretty extraordinary experience for her. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't have anywhere to be. There's no expectations on her besides staying silent. And so she has this openness, and like boredom and openness and unscheduled time, and like these things are actually really important for creative thought. So Gideon definitely would have had more time to develop that as a habit and practice. But now there's like this opportunity that Harrow was completely unable to really engage to. Like, she can't really appreciate the architecture. She can't really like casually observe the other houses in their own moments. Like, she's so focused that Gideon's curiosity is presenting her information that Harrow would have no access to because Gideon has this undelegated time.
That's a good point now that you say it like that, because when we get to the workout room, when Gideon is investigating the door, you get a very textured description of the door, implying that, because when I was re-listening to it, I was trying to think of the door literally, like I was trying to see try to get what she was seeing. But now that you say it like that, I don't think she was seeing it. We're getting what she's feeling. She's running her hand over the door and the scales, and like she's having an extremely tactile interaction with that piece of furniture or architecture.
Regarding the comment about Gideon's intelligence too, I think it's really interesting to see how she views herself versus how Harrow talks about her, because Harrow talks about her as illiterate and stupid, and Harrow calls her an idiot early in this chapter. And Gideon says she could have filled in for Dr. Skellibone without practicing a single theorem. She views herself as like really having a lot of insight about bone magic and necromancy, even though that's certainly not how Harrow talks about her. I kind of wonder about this moment of Gideon noticing the sophistication. Do you think that this is reflective of just her experience on the ninth and her general intelligence, or do you think that this is kind of evidence for sensitive Gideon, that she does have this latent necromancy due to her parentage?
That's a good point. I think a bit of both. I think we see most of Gideon's skill in her fighting, but I can't imagine she was without tutor herself, right? But that's a good point. I think part of it's probably from the latent parentage as you said. I wonder, now that I think about it, I wonder, do we see more Gideon's curiosity as a sense of her knowledge, or the subtle hints at the thaumaturgy stuff? Because I'm thinking about in the scene where she bounds herself to Harrow, and Harrow's walking across the force field or whatever, and part of that solution wasn't that Gideon being like, you can just like, part of it was an explanation, wasn't it? Kind of helping Haro fill in some of the pieces of using her to siphon her.
There's a moment where Gideon solves a puzzle by suggesting that Harrow does that. I can't quite place it either.
In Gideon's experience of this door frame and talking about like the force sensitivity thing, I can't think of where this is mentioned, but like, you know, except maybe in like talking about necromancers of the cohort sitting on like thanergic dirt while in space, material can retain thanergic energies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this implication that it can, but we also have the implication that it's a superstition.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two possible realities in terms of how like inert, non-living or non-expired material feels energetically. This was a lab. Mm-hmm. So this place had a lot of time and thanergic forces probably happening within it. Possibly even a lictor was born in this room. That possibly exists. Like in this like tactile experience that Gideon is having, so much of the description of Harrow's necromancy involves like really fine descriptions of hands. Like there's this kind of there isn't an explicit sensory language associated with necromancy, but there's kind of a vibe that feels like it could be experienced sensorily in this way that Gideon might be more open, more able to perceive the energy than like she is aware of, but she's trying to kind of still make sense of this input.
And yeah, that's true. I believe that, yeah. And you know, now that I mention it, it's probably the first time she's receiving different input, right? Because on the night, everything would have been so commonplace, she would not have known if what she was experiencing was different. But here, there's now like very explicit moments of, I mean, we don't know if he heard Haro, this we know a bit later, but like everything is so bright and new. So like she's just getting so much feedback.
Yeah. Has anyone yet to try and make like a map of Kanan House? Is that a thing yet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been a number of maps.
Okay. It very much gives the effect of like a labyrinthine type building. Like Gideon has experienced Durbra, which doesn't give the impression that it's organized or easy to navigate in any way. So like she's at ease in this kind of labyrinthine space, mm-hmm. but it's not described like she's really like trying to keep track of where she is or that she's made sense of where she is. Like it's very in the moment.
It's also only the second place she's ever been. And she would have made her mental map of Durbra very naturally by growing up there. So she doesn't have specific skills around mapping and wayfinding in a new place. She's never been a new place.
But, and, you know, we learn a little bit in the fact that that is in no way a deterrent. Like, that's actually, like, encouraging. Gideon's desire to go out into the unknown, you know, we establish, I think the cohort being Gideon's like idea of an escape early on was because that was the best option. But there is a part of this desire to go out into the unknown that is part of who she is.
Do y'all have any sense of what the five little circles joined with lines is that's above this lab door? Because there are so many times when Mirror describes something in language that makes it seem really weird, but then you're like, oh, that's the S that everybody drew on their notebooks. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like, so it seems like this is pointing to a real symbol that we would recognize if we saw it, but Gideon doesn't recognize it. Do you know what this would be? Like, what the five little circles are?
I've been thinking about that a lot, and I have come up with nothing.
Oh, I thought it might be, like, you know, the occult star? Occult star? Like the pentagram?
Oh.
I couldn't be off, because I guess Gideon would have nugged once. But,
yeah, I also went there at first, but yeah, the lack of, like, description of orientation, and it's only saying that there's lines between them, like, could be either that they are in a line, or that they are in, like, a shape. It's not actually clear to me which.
I'm seeing a theory that it might be a constellation, possibly Aries, which is linked to Mars and the second house.
Okay. Constellation, yeah.
But I don't know.
So I've been trying, as we're reading this chapter, to start like making a map in my brain. So it's kind of giving us these spaces that we have later scenes in. And my guts started clenching immediately when we got to this door. Like my anxiety was building. But I actually put the thing that ups one of the things that upsets me most about this book behind this door. I put like us learning about Jane Marie's death behind this door. But it turns out that I was wrong. But the vibes are still deeply unsettling. We're talking about what's actually behind this door, and we determined it was a lab.
Where does Jean Marie die? Because she does die in one of the labs. It's possible that you're still right.
Can we find a map?
This is room X203, which is Gideon Prime and Pyrrha's lab, and where they were staying in the facility. And this is where Gideon tries to hide with Jean Marie. So this is where Jean Marie is killed. This is also where Gideon finds the note with her name on it that says one flesh, one end. And so this room is, yeah, the tightness in your stomach is completely reasonable. This room has the seeds of fucking everything going wrong right in it.
I really there's a few things that like as I'm revisiting this stuff after my like remembering my first read, I remember the cup of tea. And that's like one of the first things I remember. But the second thing I remember is how unsettling I felt reading about this. Like I was like, this, I don't know, this door is just scary. Another thing that we were discussing prior to even starting recording was different interpretations of the dialogue of the third. There is a soliloquy. I want to say it's the Alas, poor Yorick. No, it's the nobler suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, right? The main character is kind of reflecting on the moment, and there may be someone behind a curtain listening. And the meaning changes drastically depending on whether or not you conclude or it is directed and presented that there is someone behind that curtain.
Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 4. Polonius is hiding behind a curtain to
Polonius is hiding
eavesdrop
behind a
on the
curtain.
conversation between Hamlet and his mother.
Yes. That's okay. I thought it was Hamlet, but I thought I was wrong. So, okay.
Okay. But it's that same one where not knowing who is who like changes the vibe.
Wait a minute.
So mystical oblique claptrap, like that feels very nefarious to me.
That's what I wrote down. We as we were preparing to record this episode, Claire asked who was who, and I answered very confidently. And then as soon as I looked back at the book, I realized I was very confident about one section, but that one section didn't actually match up with the beginning. And so I was like, I actually don't know. I don't know. Let's fight about it. Mystical oblique claptrap. I also wrote down as Nibirius. And then I wrote down Ianthe for the drawling because that fits how I hear her voice. But then
And
I can't imagine Nibirius responding. A lateral puzzle isn't a trial.
yes, I think it is Nibirius, Peronabeth, and then Ianthe, because Peronabeth doesn't care where she is as long as she's with her sister.
That's what I thought first, except the third voice doesn't get introduced until later, which suggests that it's just been two people going back and forth. And so I'm like,
Suggests, but when the third voice is introduced, it's not introduced as a third voice, but the third voice, which implies that it was introduced earlier.
it does say a third voice. At the top of 98, I didn't think the food was that bad, said a third voice.
Oh, there we go. Okay, thank you. I didn't see that.
Yeah, this is why I'm like, okay, but who? Because that would totally solve it for me. That I could see Corona saying what that the first house isn't treating us fairly. And it does seem like the first person has to be Nibirius because that person says to write to your father and complain. That has to be
Yes.
Nibirius.
That would be weird for Ianthe or Coronabeth to say to the that would just be weird.
Right. They would say our father, because they wouldn't be writing to Nibirius's father. Who the fuck is he? I mean, a prince probably, but like that's not, yeah, so that has to be Nibirius. But that suggests that the lateral puzzle isn't a trial is also Nibirius, which I guess it is possible.
Well, no, I think the lateral, I think that statement is just Ianthe. I think all three are talking together because when it says ever the conspiracy theorist, That would be Corona Beth responding to, I mean, her poking fun of her sister.
But then why introduce a third
Or,
voice later on?
because Gideon is watching them come down. And right now they just hear footsteps and stuff, but they're hiding in the shadow. And they're hiding in the shadow. It's like seeing someone come from behind you in a hallway and then coming in front of you.
But it's a third, like a third voice suggests to me that that's the first time Gideon is hearing it.
So one of the things that might be affecting this is the fact that, and we're introduced as this sound that Gideon is hearing is coming into the edges of Gideon's hearing. Not long after the third voice, it's mentioned about Gideon reflecting on the similarity between the second and the third voice, which
Yeah.
means that she might have not have been clearly distinct between them herself earlier on.
Oh,
Yeah, between the
yeah.
sisters. Sure, that makes sense.
That's true. There, the first section could be confused because she's confused.
Yeah. She doesn't have the sound is further away. It's just not clear. So I mean, to me, this is Mir specifically saying, I want you to play with this.
Well,
And because chewing on it, so looking at this theory of whether or not this third statement is Nibirius or not, this to me, initially I was like, oh, this is Iantha because she's like reflecting on the situation. But this is a kind of both the second and the third statement to me don't code to how Ianthe views the world or solves problems. She's not going to be like, oh, they're not treating us fairly. Like, she'd never give a shit about that. She's like, I'm going to win. I don't give a shit about the conditions. And the idea that she called geriatric playing mind games, again, she doesn't care how other people treat her in regards to her winning. These aren't things that are to me important to Ianthe.
That's fair.
I'm coming around to Knight's attributions here. I take your meaning that Nibirius cares much more than Ianthe about how he's being treated. Nibirius is very status conscious, but the third line and the fifth line do seem to be coming from different perspectives because, yeah, the fifth line is the first voice, which we know is Nibirius. So we know that the fifth line is saying, no, we need to be talking about the shuttles. So I take that as maybe the third line and the fifth line being different people.
What if the second line was Ianthe mocking Nibirius?
Oh, that makes sense.
Very possible, but that would make the third line. Do we make that Nibirius then as well? And we're back to the idea that Corona hasn't spoken yet.
So I think it could be Nibirius in the sense of this. His theories about it are more social and about fairness and about this system that they're in, this game that they're playing is unjust and stupid. Like, he's not actually thinking about how to win it. He's not actually thinking about it in terms of lictorhood. He's judging the social environment. And so, mystical oblique claptrap, what? That the first house isn't treating us fairly, says Ianthe, who doesn't give a shit about whether or not,
I know.
her lack of caring about it is actually why she's mentioning it, because she thinks it's so stupid that Nibirius cares.
I think that makes sense, and I could see Ianthe calling Nibirius a conspiracy theorist before I could see Corona calling Ianthe a conspiracy theorist.
That's fair. I think I like Claire's idea of I think the voices sound so similar, so it is Ianthe and Corona Beth responding to Nibirius, but Gideon doesn't realize that because they just sound similar far away.
Yeah, so the second line and the fourth line, sorry, the fourth line could actually be Corona Beth, even though it says the second voice. So it's the second voice, it's Gideon perceiving Corona Beth's first statement as the second voice because of that similarity.
Yeah.
This is what I think. Yes.
My notes are now marked Nibirius, Ianthe or Corona Beth, Nibirius, Ianthe or Corona Beth, Nibirius. So the first thing that we're confident is Corona Beth is I didn't think the food was that bad.
Yes.
Which everyone immediately ignores.
I think Corona Beth's description is very interesting when we first meet her because she's almost a cavalier, and I think that's what the point of that description is, right? She's almost put together enough. Stunning, always. Love her. But Cronabeth is half tucked in. She's almost doing the thing.
Yeah, I see Coronabeth as very intentionally messy. Like she is this self-consciously sloppy sort of performatively languid kind of person as being part of her lifestyle of luxury and ease. In the category of offensive foreshadowing, I want to point out that the first real description we get of Ianthe's body is that it is as though she had been taken to pieces and put back together without any genius. A thing that does happen to her. And she then gets taken apart again and put back together with quite a lot of genius.
Do we get a clear description of Iberius in this scene?
He is described as having a lot of hair, an aquiline face, and a self-satisfied little jacket.
And we also have the very specific word bouffant, which has a few different things that we could pull from it. But bouffant is a clowning style, a satirical clowning style, making fun of higher class people in a way that dialogues with like the audience that is observing an interaction between the bouffant clown and the person of higher status. Like it's implying some interesting things here, but there was like an aesthetic that was associated with this theatrical style. I most strongly associate it with a set of characters from a Cirque du Soleil show, but it's very ornate, but in a way that is cartoonish. So it's like ornate versions of the aristocratic dress, but in a way that's kind of ridiculous.
Elvis is sometimes said to have worn a bouffant, although a fairly mild one. But this was really big in like certain kinds of 80s music.
The hairstyle bouffant? Yeah,
Specifically
totally.
a male one.
Yeah,
It's a
yeah.
very tall, very high effort hairstyle.
My favorite bouffants are in anime. There are some epic bouffants in anime.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I think JoJo, I have never seen the JoJo verse, but I'm pretty sure it has some very good bouffants.
Yeah. It's funny when you were describing him as a clown, what actually popped in my head was the idea of him being a puppet. You would dress up and paint your puppets right very elaborately. And considering what happens to them, I think him being a puppet would be most appropriate.
I'm suddenly imagining the third as a Punch and Judy show.
I'm not familiar with this.
Punch and Judy was a theatrical style of puppets that had archetypal characters that were fairly melodramatic, so the costumes would indicate the personality type, very like, what's the phrase? I want to say it's out of the like commedia dell'arte archetypes, but basically you have these specific both like gender, vocation, economic, and personality type cues, and then they have these, melodramatic interactions. And one of the classic visuals of them is domestic violence, which we get in Cronabeth's reaction to Nibirius having anything bad to say about Ianthe.
I think it's interesting that Ianthe correctly guesses that the shuttles were dropped off the ledge, and Nibirius finds this completely unbelievable because of the expense it implies. So we're getting this hint that like Ianthe is absolutely smart as a whip. Ianthe like has a great sense to clock what's going on because Gideon knows this because she saw it, but Ianthe knows it because it's what she would do.
Yeah, I think she knew someone was there the whole time, right? She obviously didn't know who or what was there, but whatever it was, she considers herself powerful enough to not be bothered by it, right? Like she doesn't even address Gideon, but like whatever's in the shadows to her until their backs are turned, right? Like,
Until the others can't hear her as well.
yeah. And
Ianthe makes this warning into the dark. I would not attract attention from the necromancer of the third house.
yeah.
Ianthe feels confident enough that she is given Gideon a piece of very, very unique information.
Yes, the necromancer.
There's a point at which Ianthe corrects Corona and has Corona and Babs leave the space. There's a line at which Ianthe doesn't want whoever is in the darkness to see this interaction. She controls when this ends. Like, knowing that there is someone in the darkness observing them, she says, okay, then we're done with this game. So, like, while, like, yes, she's confident, there's also like things that she doesn't want part of that impression. She's still controlling how people are perceiving the third in quite a intentional way.
That suggests that this mixed performance of Corona as Bimbo and Corona as Necromancer is already something that they're semi-publicly managing. Ianthe knows that somebody's listening when she says, you know, your brain can only deal with one emotion at a time.
Yeah, and calling her sister Bimbo and all that.
Yeah. And describing that as a poorly hidden fact.
Yeah. I think she maybe what she Ianthe is trying to do is bait them. Like, she's expecting whoever is listening to come and attack later. And I think the threat is if you attack, even if you know this information, you'll be worse the wearer for it, right?
Oh, she's maybe setting out information as a trap itself
Yes.
to see who acts on it. That's interesting.
Yes.
Because then she can find out who's hiding. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like
Yeah.
she's giving them
I
a
was
little
saying.
opportunity. Yeah.
Smart.
Like, she's giving them not only an opportunity, but a reason, right? Like, she's, like you said, both the dirt being derogatory towards her sister and at the end saying, don't mess with the necromancer of the third. So if someone was to go out and say, there is only one necromancer the third, and then present a challenge, it would be a problem.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I'm like, okay, so Ianthe's been aware of someone overhearing the whole time. And so everything she's said is knowing that she's being perceived. She's setting something up because she now sees this as an opportunity. She is taking advantage of this unexpected situation. And I was like, what is she getting out of this? She's getting information when someone takes advantage of the bait. Because, yeah, like Harrow, she's. Everything she does is obsessively considered and strategic. Whether, like, I think she's a bit more, no, she's emotional, just a different way.
Nibirius's response in standing up for Coronabeth here also suggests that Ianthe isn't always like this, that this is that specific performance, that this isn't just like how they casually talk to each other in private. He's surprised by it. He's reacting to it and he's receiving that feedback. This isn't how you react to that.
And if he had been expecting a correction of this degree, probably wouldn't have said it.
Right. Or if he had known that Coronabeth is like, oh no, she can totally talk to me like that. If that was casual, he wouldn't have reacted to it. It would be
Yeah.
normalized.
Yeah, because we can assume that Ianthe knew from the beginning.
I have never read this scene through that lens before. Man, poor Nibirius. He got trapped so bad in that trap. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaley and edited by Han Kaley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Han and Knight. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.